Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm your host, Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. We're now at the halfway point of the year, and so much has already happened. So it's a great time to reflect back on our year-ahead outlook and what we got right and what we got wrong. Importantly, it's a time to take stock of what we've learned and to reposition portfolios for what may lie ahead. So to discuss our mid-year outlook entitled Cross Currents and Divergence Amidst an Increasing AI Surge, I'm excited to be joined by David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Welcome, David. Welcome
back. Glad to be here.
So, David, I want to get started with you. As you were recently sitting down to write our U.S. economy and global economy section, what struck you as the most surprising thing versus what you had written for the year ahead outlook?
Well, a few things. I think a good way to look at it is at the start of the year, my forecast was 2024, kind of like it was 2 years ago, which was 2% growth, zero recessions, inflation running at about 2%, and unemployment ending the year at about 4%. Halfway through, I'm sort of a decade later. I'm 2034. I think we'll still average about 2% growth for the year. I think it will still avoid a recession, but for reasons which we'll get into, it looks like inflation will be hotter, so maybe 3% year over year on inflation by the end of the year. And I still think the unemployment rate will come down to 4%. And in the midst of, with that changing forecast, what really moved the needle here? I think there were three things. First of all, income tax refunds weren't quite as strong as we thought. Now, they were up 18% in terms of the total value of refunds paid out this filing season relative to last year. We actually thought it was going to be more than that based on the original cost estimates from the OBBBA. So consumers got some assistance from income tax refunds, but not as strong as we thought. And that is keeping consumer spending just a little bit slower in the middle of the year than we thought it would be. Offsetting that, though, the AI surge has been even stronger. I mean, we keep on updating our numbers in terms of how much the various hyperscalers are going to spend on capital spending this year. But we're seeing these broadening ripples from this extraordinary AI splash. And so it's not just affecting these companies. Financials are having a very good year because of the earnings, because of a new renewed M&A boom and IPO boom, which is pretty much related to the good stock market. We're seeing good returns out of utilities and a lot of spending on infrastructure. So overall, that part of the economy is doing very well. And if you look at, even in first quarter GDP, you look at the strength that we saw in investment spending on equipment and also investment spending on R&D. I mean, those things are really powering the economy forward. So those things are kind of offsetting. And they wouldn't, without this third factor, we'd still be at a 2024 economy. But the third factor was the war in Iran. We didn't expect that to happen. Obviously, last summer there was an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. That might have been it, but instead we're obviously engaged in a war with Iran. We've had a prolonged ceasefire, but the effect of that has been to close the Strait of Hormuz, to raise gasoline prices, raise energy prices around the world. That has slowed the economy in Europe and some other places. Hasn't slowed the economy that much in the United States, but it has added to inflation. And so we're now looking at inflation prints, touching 4% in the middle of the year. That's certainly higher than we thought. And even if we see some resolution in the Persian Gulf relatively quickly here, we still think that the residual effect of drawing down those oil inventories will keep inflation at more like a 3% year-over-year number at the end of the year. So I'd say in summary, consumers a little weaker, investment spending a little bit stronger, but the wild card has been the outbreak of war in the Middle East.
And David, you've talked a lot about the divergences. So maybe just separating surface level, what are you seeing overall for growth, jobs, and inflation? But then what are some of the important divergences?
Well, that's right. I mean, we've on average, the economy looks okay. In fact, it honestly looks boring if we had a 2034 economy. But we're very aware of this huge divergence, which is almost threatening to rip the whole thing apart at the seams. Yeah. There are certainly increasing risks. So we've seen a continued divergence in terms of the stock market, which is doing very well. May saw the stock market hit an all-time record high. Meanwhile, consumer sentiment hit an all-time record low in May. Yeah. And so it's clear that the public is feeling very gloomy at a time when the stock market is doing very well. And that's just one aspect of a K-shaped economy in terms of corporate profits are doing very well, investment spending is doing very well. but the average consumer, particularly having been hit by higher energy prices, really feel like they're not doing very well. So that's one aspect of it, this widening gap between those who are doing well in this economy and those who aren't doing as well. And then obviously more on the market side of things, you're seeing this huge divergence between anything that is latched onto the AI theme, which has done very well, and everything else which is trailing behind it. We also continue divergence in terms of politics. We've got a very politicized environment here, a very polarized environment. So we have all these dimensions of divergence in the economy. And they don't necessarily mean there's going to be a crisis, but it does increase the risk of seeing a big switch from one side to the other. And so I think that does add for the potential for volatility, both in the economy, but also in markets going forward.
And you mentioned the political polarization. This is a midterm year.
Yep.
In the lead up to it or after, once we know the results, could anything change your outlook?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's you can look at the history, you can figure out what's likely. I mean, I remember leading up to the 2024 election, I thought the presidency was an absolute toss-up. But I did think the Democrats had a slight edge in the House, and they could take the House even if they lost the presidency. As it turned out, the Republicans took the House. And this time around, even with redistricting, it looks like the Democrats may take the House. And the Republicans, more likely than not, will maintain control of the Senate, because it's a very heavy lift for the Democrats to take the Senate back. But that could be wrong. And it could be the Republicans manage to hold on to the House and Senate. And that does make a difference. If the Democrats take the House, then you're going to see much more gridlock in Washington than we've seen to this point. And so even if the administration wanted to put in some more fiscal stimulus to stimulate the economy ahead of the 2028 presidential elections, chances are that would go nowhere, because while Democrats might be approve of some stimulus and are only going to do that if they can fund it through tax increases on either corporations or wealthier households. And so you're likely to get into a sort of a political deadlock, which would then reduce the likelihood of further stimulus. I mean, usually you get big changes in Washington or big stimulus in Washington when you've got single-party government. And so I think that probably does matter. If you have single-party government, maybe stronger growth, but maybe also more inflation. You got a divided government after November, then I think that takes a little bit out of both growth and inflation for 2027 and 2028.
And how do you see a different part of D.C., the Federal Reserve, reacting to these cross currents, especially the growth versus inflation?
Well, as little as possible, to be honest. We've obviously got a change in leadership at the Federal Reserve, with Kevin Warsh taking over as the Fed chair. And Jay Powell leaving that, but not leaving the Board of Governors. Mm-hmm. I think Kevin Warsh's job, as is the job of every Fed chair, will be to try to form a consensus within the Federal Reserve. And, you know, it's one thing to get the job, it's another thing to do the job well. And doing the job well means you've got to bring the team with you. Mm-hmm. And because of that, even though he has made some statements in favor of maybe lowering interest rates or having room to lower interest rates, if you look at the economic data, you know, as I said, with inflation now, even by December, maybe running at 3%, which would be a full percentage point above the Fed's target, it's very hard to make the argument the Federal Reserve needs to ease immediately. At the same time, you know, I don't personally think that interest rates are way too low. I don't think that raising them would do anything particularly useful here. So I think it's quite likely the Federal Reserve does nothing for the rest of the year, at least through December. And then going into next year, if you have that sort of fiscal gridlock and less fiscal stimulus, if inflation does come down below 2%, if economic growth comes down below 2%, then I think you might get some rate changes from the Federal Reserve. I know futures markets are currently, as we're recording this, are pricing in a Fed rate hike. I just don't see it. I think it's too uncertain. If you get some resolution of the situation in the Middle East, the trend in inflation will be for it to come down. It may be slow, but it will come down. And in that environment, I don't think the Federal Reserve really want to do anything.
Especially, as you know, there's no wage pressure. There's no demand side push for inflation. Right?
Well, that's right. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of the U.S. economy right now is we have an unemployment rate at 4.30%. So it's relatively low by historical standards. It's very close to the Fed's target of 4.2%. And yet, in May, the year-over-year wage gain of 3.4% for wages, for average hourly earnings for all workers, that was the second lowest number we've seen in 5 years.
Wow.
What's more, that's the second lowest number in 5 years, even at a time when consumer inflation, whether it's measured by CPI or PCE, is running well above that. So it's actually a second consecutive month of real wage declines. And even in that environment, workers don't seem to have the ability or maybe even the energy to demand wage hikes. And so in that environment, that's good for corporate profits. I think it allows companies to maintain good margins, but it also gets rid of the whole price-wage spiral. I mean, when people talk about sticky inflation, it's because you have a price increase that causes a wage increase, causes a price increase, causes a wage increase, you get a price-wage spiral. If you don't have stronger wage growth, you're not going to have that. And so I think it's a very important aspect of this environment that for whatever reason, American workers feel like they can't get a wage increase. But that is also, I think, going to be give a negative bias to inflation going forward.
And David, to wrap things up, when you were writing the global economy piece, what stood out to you in terms of the rest of the world growth, inflation, central banks, and what you think that means for the dollar from here?
Well, I think, first of all, in growth, there is a difference between what's happening in Europe and what's happening in Asia. So in Europe, both, you know, the UK has got plenty of issues, and the European Union, or the Eurozone, has also got issues. And I think that they're particularly sensitive to natural gas prices and other prices coming, other problems coming out of the Middle East. And, you know, they're not self-sufficient in energy in the way the United States is. So this has hurt Europe significantly. It hasn't, I don't think it's enough to cause a European recession, but it certainly has slowed momentum down in the Eurozone, and momentum is relatively slow in the UK also. So overall, that's pretty damp. It's a lot cooler than we would have thought going into this year, particularly you do have a lot of fiscal stimulus from more defence spending coming out of Germany, but that's being negated by sort of general consumer gloom with higher energy prices. Meanwhile, if you go over to Asia, we've got, first of all, you've got a tech boom going on in Taiwan and Korea, which is obviously very obvious in the stock markets. But also, you've got China focusing a lot more on new forms of technology, on robotics, on AI, on its own data center capabilities, on alternative energy. So there are problems in the Chinese economy. I think Chinese consumers, kind of like European consumers, don't really want to spend. But overall, they've got a fairly strong investment spending wave going on there, and much more productive investment spending than the housing investment they were doing 10 years ago. So I think overall that looks pretty good. Japan is holding in okay right now. I think both Japan and China had massive reserves of petroleum before this crisis in the Middle East, and that has helped shield them to this point. From the effects of that. So overall, Asia is doing pretty well. Europe is pretty soggy right now. But I think overall, the global, as soon as the situation in the Gulf is resolved, I think the overall global economy will pick up a bit.
Looking for industry-leading insights on markets and the economy? Our Guide to the Markets illustrates a comprehensive array of market and economic histories, trends, and statistics through clear charts and graphs. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTM.
Meanwhile, both in Japan and in the Eurozone, you've got central banks who are much more likely to hike than the Federal Reserve. I think the Federal Reserve, for various political reasons, but also because they honestly can see inflation coming down in the long run, they're not likely to hike. The Bank of Japan, though, we were talking with our Japanese strategists earlier on this week, and they do think that the Bank of Japan will have to raise rates once or maybe twice this year as they try to get rates back to a more normal level. And the European Central Bank, although, to be honest, they probably shouldn't be talking about hikes, but they are talking about hikes. They feel like they've always tried to portray themselves as hawkish when they had the opportunity to do so. But I think they're likely to hike rates too. So now you've got a situation where you could look forward into 2027 and maybe the Federal Reserve cutting rates. Meanwhile, you've got the Bank of Japan and the ECB raising rates. That should narrow the rate gap between these different countries, and that should bring the dollar down. So overall, I think the global economy has taken a hit from the Persian Gulf crisis, but I think it will still grow. And I think there are other areas which are India obviously is still booming here. But I think that the central banks will take very different paths, and that could bring the dollar down. And it's one reason why people should diversify around the world, as I know you're going to talk about.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
But actually, let me pass it over to you. So I told you what I thought was a surprise in terms of the economy. How about in markets and investing?
Yeah, listening to you, I think two things really stand out. We knew AI was going to remain one of the most important investment themes. But I think what's been surprising is just the magnitude of it and its dominance in terms of global markets. The magnitude, you know, there was already expectations for double-digit earnings growth if we look at the U.S., yet earnings expectations have been revised up 15 percentage points since the start of the year, mm-hmm. instead of coming down, as is normally the case. I mean, just look at absolutely booming earnings growth in the tech sector, up 50%, memory, 350%. It's also been absolutely explosive, as you mentioned, for parts of Asia, especially Korea, Taiwan, everything to do with semiconductors. For emerging markets, earnings expectations have moved higher by 35 percentage points. Mm-hmm. So the magnitude is just even bigger than we had expected, all related to the AI CapEx spending. I think also the dominance as a theme. If, you know, you're a company unrelated to AI, you're having a hard time seeing inflows or even, frankly, seeing very exciting earnings growth. It really has been the dominant driver. When I think about the second big surprise, of course, as you mentioned, the Iran war, and as a result, what we've been seeing in fixed income, we certainly didn't expect yields to have shot higher and fixed income returns to be basically flat to slightly negative mm-hmm. on the year. So you've definitely seen a very big repricing of this change in the Fed, especially when it comes to short-term rates. The two-year yield has moved up 70 basis points already this year. Certainly not what we had on our bingo card.
Well, yes. So, I mean, at these yields, you think fixed income is now attractive?
I think so. I think when you look at the two-year having moved up so much, the expectations now of a full Fed rate hike and the possibility of a second for this year, and listening to you, not something that we expect to actually take place. In addition, I think if you look at the short end of the curve, you now have the 2 years sitting 60 basis points above cash rates. Mm-hmm. That's really attractive, at least to take the step from ultra short, kind of cash-like instruments mm-hmm. into short duration. What I still don't think is that attractive is continuing to move the pendulum towards long duration. There, you still have a lot of these question marks, especially around the fiscal situation. Mm-hmm. Will you have that extra stimulus or not in the lead up to the midterms and the aftermath of it? But definitely a lot of value on the short end. And I think if you look across corporate credit, municipal debt, household debt or securitized debt, you have really attractive all-in yields. You're talking about a range of 5 to 7%, depending on what you're looking at. The spreads are tight, but the all-in yield is good. So the Fed mm-hmm. is on hold, but the income in fixed income is absolutely not. Performance has been a bit challenged, but hopefully as we price out those Fed rate hikes, once again, yields can drift a little bit lower. So you have a little bit of capital appreciation plus, of course, this attractive income.
And I think it's worth emphasizing that even if inflation does come down, and even if you have some sort of gridlock in Congress in terms of new stimulus, the budget is very out of balance to start with. Yeah. The debt to GDP ratio is already on track to rise maybe to 100%, 120% of GDP in 2034, maybe 125% if we don't have tariff revenue to replace the tariff revenue that was lost when the IEEPA tariffs were declared illegal. So, I absolutely understand the reluctance to go too long duration in this environment. Turning back to equities, as you say, the AI theme has been the only theme in town.
Yes.
Is that going to continue for the rest of the year?
So I think listening to your forecast, David, if indeed we do see that reacceleration in the middle of the year, then maybe you do have some rotation within the market just because you've had such a run-up in anything related to the AI supply chain that maybe you do see a little bit of rotation into your more traditionally cyclical areas of the market. The question is the lasting power. If it's just for a couple of quarters and then you get that 2% or below growth, then really I think investors are going to stay myopically focused on the AI theme. Mm-hmm. The one area of the market outside of just pure AI CapEx that could have more lasting power, though, is something like financials, where you just need a good enough economy to keep default rate low And then you have these other tailwinds of rising capital market activity and deregulation pushing up corporate lending. Besides that, I think it's still all about the AI CapEx build out. But something I think is interesting is the climate still favors AI this year, but we've really gone on to a new season here. Mm-hmm. For example, it's no longer about who's doing the CapEx spending. It's about who's actually seeing those dollars. So just follow the CapEx dollars. Mm-hmm. And it goes to areas like semiconductor, like industrial equipment, power. So it has really broadened out within the AI theme. The second thing I think we've seen this year is really that more AI CapEx can be good for some, mm-hmm. but not everybody. And so investors are already rushing to price in who's going to be disrupted, not just who's doing the disrupting. Mm-hmm. So we have seen a big sell-off in software already. I think going forward, a little bit more selectivity there. You know, there are some business models that are going to be disrupted, already are, versus some that have just bigger moats around them or can even benefit, like cybersecurity. So still very AI-driven, but let's not forget that the theme has and will continue to evolve from here.
And so, I mean, you're talking about seasons of investing. There have been some very long seasons in which international equities were better and then U.S. equities were better. And we've seen 2025 was a very good year for international equities. 2026 looks good, but we're not getting the dollar tailwind that we've had in the past. So what are your views on international equities from here?
So actually, it's the second year in a row that we've seen international as a whole outperform the U.S. Last year, outperformed by 1,500 basis points, mm-hmm. the biggest since 2009. This year, the complex as a whole is outperforming by 430 basis points. So I think it's a proof statement that this is a much more resilient asset class. And that's because it's all about, same as the U.S., secular over cyclical themes. This year, the star of the show by far has been emerging markets, and that has everything to do with the AI CapEx story. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that concerns me about the emerging market story. The earnings are there. The thing is, it's become very concentrated. Just three semiconductor companies in Korea and Taiwan are representing about 70% of EM return this year. And it represents about 25% of the index as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's more to the global AI story than just three companies. And I do think it's important to make sure that we're also investing in areas where we're seeing actual innovation take place in Asia. Certainly a lot of leadership there in physical AI around robotics, for mm-hmm. example. So I do think it's still, as long as investors are focused on the AI story, emerging markets and specifically North Asia can keep leading. I just hope that it broadens out. The region that has lagged this year versus last year has been Europe, because as you mentioned, net oil importer expectations for growth have cooled. The interesting thing to note, though, is that earnings have still been pretty solid in Europe. And I think Europe is really important to include in a portfolio together with Japan, because it isn't about AI. Mm-hmm. It is about other sectors, other secular themes that are very much still in play. They tend to be on the value side, things like aerospace and defense, which is still benefiting from much more spending on defense and infrastructure. I was just talking to our French strategist, Lilia, who's in town over lunch, and she was mentioning that European defense companies are getting rushed, expensive orders coming in from the Middle East because of the Iran war. Mm-hmm. So really powerful theme still. You're seeing credit growth and the end of negative rates still benefit European Japanese banks. And then lastly, you have much more of a focus on shareholders, more buybacks, more of a focus on return on equity overseas than you've ever had. So I do think international can still keep outperforming. I just think that as soon as you have a bit more of a resolution on the Iran war, that you can have a bit more catch up in areas like Europe, which have lagged.
So I remember as we went into this year, the whole idea of diversifying away from just the mega cap concentrated AI theme was important. And and that diversification is really important from a risk management perspective. And it seems to me with AI even more dominant as a theme right now, it is more important than ever to have a way of diversifying. So apart from, you know, high quality fixed income, value stocks, developed country stocks outside the U.S., Are there any other areas that you can add to a portfolio to just add that extra layer of diversification?
I think diversification is getting to become so difficult to actually do, mm-hmm. because this dominance of AI is permeating across asset classes. Even something like investment grade fixed income, mm-hmm. used to be all about financials, industrials. Now, even there, you're seeing a lot of issuance by the so-called hyperscalers to fund all of this mm-hmm. AI CapEx. And you've seen a five-fold increase in the share of tech in the investment grade mm-hmm. index. So even there, you're already getting more and more exposure to AI. Same with emerging markets. It's mm-hmm. also another side of the AI coin. So that's where I really think it's important to focus on where can you actually get different sectors that are being driven by different themes. Mm-hmm. They can still be secular themes, but just not AI mm-hmm. CapEx related in case you get a disappointment coming out of some of this tech innovation. If you think about asset classes as a whole, they're also meant to diversify some big macro risks. Mm-hmm. One of them, recession, for example, not in your forecast, but kind of like death and taxes, it will happen again at one point. And I do still think treasuries mm-hmm. With some duration are still the best way to diversify a recession risk. Let's not forget, when you do see something like a 20% plus correction in mm-hmm. the equity market, if you had a little fixed income in your portfolio as a whole can recover mm-hmm. double as fast versus if you had just stocks. Not the only macro risk, though. We have a lot of inflation risks, fiscal risks, and that's, of course, where bonds, again, aren't going to help us. Mm-hmm. And that's where we tend to look at private markets quite a lot. You have a lot that can help diversify the defense there, like real assets, real estate, infrastructure, transportation, gold, plus hedge funds. So there's a lot to do if you can give up a little bit of liquidity. But in return, you get non-correlated, nice stream of income. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I think when we think about all the cross currents, it can feel a bit daunting for investors. And I think it's just about going back to basics. Really, the ABCDs of investing, appreciating the fundamentals where they are strong, mm-hmm. balancing that, though, with expectations and valuations, concentrating on where we may have a lot of concentration in portfolios, mm-hmm. in really diversifying the diversifiers.
Yep, absolutely. It's an interesting outlook, but it's one with lots of promise. There's plenty of risk there, too. And I think it's very important for people to keep an eye both on the opportunity, but also how to manage the risk in their own portfolios.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, David, for joining.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us today for our discussion on our mid-year outlook. Make sure to check out the full piece at jpmorgan.com/outlook. See you soon.
Material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.